Blog Talk Radio.
What's up, everyone? Check it out. This is Silent Cordy, and this is, guess what? You're right, Taino Radio. That's right, man, and welcome to Indigenous Caribbean Study Hour. Check this out. We have an action-packed hour with, check this out, straight out of the hills, I should say mountains of Philly. Oh, man, haven't played that in a while. This is Natalie Huber Rodriguez. What's up?
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that again. I'm so glad that's my theme song. It makes me so happy.
That's right, man. It's been a while, man.
It has, especially, and I was just in downtown Philly today, so I saw that Rocky statue, and I was like, yo, that's my jam right there.
Wait a second. Are you kidding me?
No. You know we got that statue there, right, on the Art Museum steps. We got the statue of Rocky with the hands up.
Yeah, man, but that's cool that I didn't even know that. But look, I mean, I didn't know that you were there, man. This is it. See, this is synchronicity here.
Yeah, I live right outside of there, so I always, you know, I pop in there every
That was an accident.
Okay. I was going to say, oh, we doing it again? All right.
Oh, my God. Now, we all know that your ancestry is from the mountains of Cuba, right? There we
go. Yes. Or Cubao, as our ancestors called it. You know, it's funny, like, of all the Greater Antilles and Caribbean islands that the Taino lived in, Cuba mm-hmm. is the one that has the name that's closest to what the indigenous people actually called it, you know?
Wait a second,
it was
really?
Called, yeah, because, you know, obviously we know Puerto Rico was called Puriquen, Dominican Republic was Quisqueya, Haiti was
right.
Haiti. I mean, Haiti's pretty close, but the way they spell it in the indigenous way for Cuba is that same way, or sometimes they put an O at the end of it. Apparently, it was the name that the Siboney Taino, who I am descended from, called it specifically. And I always just think that's cool that it still has something really close to its original name, you know?
Wow. That, you know what? Now that I don't think about it, it's true, because during the colonization period, right? They changed
right,
the names
right.
around.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, Cuba, apparently, its exact translation is unknown. You know, I should be saying Cuba. That's the correct way to say it, but I'm saying it my anglicized way. Yeah, but my ancestors would be kicking my ass for that. I gotta get myself in shape. But so
well,
the exact meaning, right? So the meaning is not super clear, but they say it can be translated if you put that O at the end to Cuba, like Cubao. Apparently, that was sort of a translation from the Siboney Taino, meaning where fertile land is abundant, or another term for it was Coabana, Coabana, which roughly translates to great place. So,
you know,
either way,
I've seen that translation.
It was a place to be, you know? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that right in Coabana. I remember back in the day, we used to say Coabana, so That's interesting. Well, you know, in my DNA, in my 23andMe profile, they have me in Cuba.
Right, right. That's what you told me.
So I'm interested to find out as much as I can, maybe tonight, about Cuba, the history of the, you know,
absolutely,
what's going on in Cuba. So if you want to enlighten
right.
us,
so,
man, I'm all ears.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's funny because I was, you know, I'm back in the great city of brotherly love, Philadelphia now. But just last week, I was visiting my Taino Cubano family down in Florida. So a lot of Cuban immigrants. Yeah. So a lot of Cuban people ended up in Florida because, you know, it's South Florida in particular. So it's very close to the island. A lot of people, of course, we know a lot of people fled during the Castro Revolution. But my family actually came before then, which is interesting. You know, people always say, oh, were they refugees from the revolution? And I was like, no, those were all the rich people. Those were the Spaniards or rich Spanish descended people who pretty much lost all their land and all their proper, all their wealth when the revolution happened in 59. So though that's a completely different wave and different kind of demographic of Cuban immigrants. My family came before that when Batista was still technically in charge. I don't know if anyone knows about him, but people say Castro's bad. He was way worse, in my opinion. So my family came.
Batista,
he was a
dictator, right?
He was a very, very totalitarian dictator. And things were really bad in Cuba at the time, and that is why my family decided to leave. My mom was very young at the time. She was a small child. But they immigrated first to New York, actually, and were living in kind of upper Manhattan, you know, up north in the, I guess I want to say like 120-something street up where there were a lot of other Latino immigrants. My mom said there was a lot of Puerto Ricans, a lot of Dominicans in their neighborhood.
Right.
Yeah, so that, you know, so they're in this very like barrio setting, but then after a few years they came down to Florida, as the Spanish would call it, land of the flowers, and down to sort of the Miami area, but also surrounding area. Like my family, who I was with, lived in near kind of Boca Raton area, but I do have family in Miami too. As well, and there's people who know Miami know there's the Little Havana neighborhood in Miami, which is basically like the whole Cuban neighborhood. You go there, all you'll hear is Spanish. You'll see nothing but Cuban restaurants and shops, and you know, the guys outside playing dominoes and the cigar shops and everything. So it's always fun to go back and visit my family down there, because it feels like it's so hard to get to Cuba, and has been for so long. It's like the closest I can get, you know, because it really is not far if you're at the southern tip of Florida. I have flown there back to Cuba before from South Florida, and it's like a 45-minute plane ride. You know, you could practically swim.
Oh, where?
Yeah, it's right there. Yeah. So it's so close.
Oh, so you were able
geographically.
To go.
Yeah, I was, and that's, people always ask me about that, and it's because I am Cuban-American, and I do have family there still. So it used to be, you know, we still have this embargo in place that has been, God, it's been over 60 years now, right, that this has been going on ever since that revolution. So despite the fact that the embargo is still in place, certain Cuban Americans, people who can prove that they still have family there, can go. And it used to be that we could only go every 3 years. And there's still a lot of rules and restrictions when you go, you know, in terms of you're technically not supposed to bring anything in or take anything out. We do. It's we always bring stuff, supplies, especially for the family, because with the embargo, and the way the government is set up, people are so short of supplies.
Right.
The basic things like shampoo, mm-hmm. soap, towels, clothes, toothpaste, whatever. And, of course, we bring stuff back too, but you got to be careful about it. But after the Obama administration, Cuban Americans like myself and my mother are now able to go pretty much whenever we want. We still have to kind of jump through those hoops and get that visa and everything, but we can go more liberally than, say, any other average American who was not Cuban American, who doesn't have those kinds of connections. So I am grateful for that. And I've been able to visit a couple times, visit family and friends, obviously with COVID and everything over the past year plus, hasn't been any of that. But I have gone, and it's always interesting to me, especially to talk about our indigenous roots and heritage, because I feel like when people think of Taino people or talk about Taino people, usually it's Puriken that comes to mind, or people assume a lot of the time when I say I'm Taino that I'm Puerto Rican. And there's been a lot of work done in Hispaniola and the Dominican Republic and Haiti. But I feel like Cuba kind of gets glossed, and I don't know if that's due to the political situation and how it's gone down in terms of how the Cuban culture and government treats the idea of indigenous culture, and they kind of really demoted it as it were, especially after that revolution. And I'll get into that in a little bit. But I always kind of feel like people forget about us, even though we were the biggest island of the Antilles, and there were a lot of Taino people here. And a lot happened here, or I say here. Cuba's with me wherever I go in my heart. So literally, but yeah. So when I say here, I mean in Cuba. A lot happened in terms of Taino rebellion and resistance against colonization. There's lots of stories. There's lots of important sites, cultural and archaeological sites. There's lots of artifacts that have been found. So there's really a lot there. And I always feel like people seem to forget about that when talking about Taino as a whole and as a culture. So I guess I'm just going to use this episode, especially since I was just with my family and we were talking about this, to just shine a little more light on the Taino, Taino people of Cuba specifically. So I guess I'll start with, we kind of touched on this before, but Cuba is a big island. It's the biggest island of the Greater Antilles, and it's separated in terms of the types of Taino who were there. So on the very eastern tip are the Tainos, the classical Tainos, Tainos classicals, as we call them, the people, same people who are in Puriken, same people who are in Hispaniola, common culture and language there. And then most of western Cuba and central Cuba was the they call them the western Tainos, but the other word for them is Cebuane. I've used that term before. And that is what culture that I specifically descend from is Cebuane Taino, and we're more or less the same. We're just a different band, basically. You know, lots of tribes have bands and sub bands. So the Cebuane were just a kind of slight offshoot, but spoke a common language and shared a common culture with the classic Tainos. And then the only difference is, and we've mentioned this before, all the way on that very western tip of Cuba was a completely different tribe called the Guanahatabeyes, who were they were not ethnically or linguistically related to the Taino. Their language was completely different, not mutually intelligible, culture was different, kind of a little bit of a mystery. But apparently we got on with them pretty well. You know, we traded with them. We jived with them. It was all good.
Nice.
So, you know, it's all good in terms of with the one. I mean, I'd like to learn more about the Guanahatabeyes personally, because they seem so mysterious, because they're the only tribe that wasn't Taino, and I kind of want to know where they come from. But conversation for another time, right?
Well, it's interesting that they use the I hear the word atabe in the word.
Right.
Atabe.
Yeah. apparently that name came from a person, I think, Guanajatabe, from someone, I guess, that the Spanish encountered. I think it was a woman, a cacique's wife or something, and I believe that that's where, because, you know, the Spaniards and other colonizers, they would, the names they designated for tribes kind of came from whatever they would hear them say or adjectives they used to describe them, like even Taino, you know, we know that they probably just heard our people saying, like, Taino ti, like, to greet people, and they were like, okay, these are the Taino, so... So they probably.
I love the word Taino. No one likes the word anymore.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah,
no one loves it anymore.
I love it. Okay. I think it works. It's great. It means like greetings, friend. You know, what's wrong with that?
Yeah. It's like chilling out. Let's chill. Right.
Exactly.
I like Taino.
Right.
But I'm sorry.
Yeah, I like
yeah.
it too. You know, Cebuane is same thing. I use that term with Taino interchangeably. Yeah, sometimes I'll say Cebuane Taino, just to specify more. But so going back to it, I always think it's interesting to dive into kind of the history of really what happens once the Taino of Cuba were encountered. So we know Columbus first was in Hispaniola. But then when he came back on his second journey, actually, he made a really conscious effort to colonize Cuba specifically because they saw this was like a great new land. And as I said, Cuba means fertile land and everything. So I think it was about 1508, they really made this conscious effort to colonize all of Cuba, and that meant subduing the indigenous people there, the Taino. They started in the eastern part of Cuba, what is today Baracoa, and a lot of that meant forcible conversion of the Taino to Christianity. So a big story that I grew up hearing and that I think is pretty amazing and still resonates with, and I think a lot of modern Taino people, no matter where they're from, know it, is the story of the Cacique Hatue. And he is considered such an icon in Cuba, and I'll explain why for a second.
Definitely.
Hatue, yeah, I'm sure you've probably heard of him. He was technically from Hispaniola originally, but since Hispaniola had been colonized prior to Cuba, he actually fled with a lot of his fellow warriors over to Cuba, first off to kind of escape everything that was going on Hispaniola, but also to sort of build up this rebellion in Cuba before Cuba could be colonized too. And he really did a pretty good job, all things considered. He made this very conscious effort and raised a guerrilla warfare campaign because obviously they were the underdogs, you know, they didn't have the weaponry or the numbers of the Spaniards. Disease was a big problem. And he really fought long and fought hard with this group of warriors that he brought over from Hispaniola. But also then there were warriors in Cuba who he rallied to join the cause. And they formed this really big guerrilla warfare campaign. And they, you know, they put it off for as long as they could, put off colonization for as long as they could. They fought really, really hard. But eventually, unfortunately, Hatue was captured by the Spanish within a few years after this whole resistance movement started. And I always remember this story because I remember my great uncle telling me, and I've heard it so many times since, but it still rings true and still is so powerful to me. So he's being set to burn at the stake. You know, that's how they punished people back in the day. So they have him bound to the stake and ready to burn him alive. And then this Catholic priest comes up to him and says, okay, so you're going to be executed, but before you're executed. He offered him a chance to renounce his indigenous faith and convert to Christianity, since he's now gonna die. This is your last chance. You can convert to Christianity and you'll go to heaven, even though we're gonna kill you. You'll go to heaven, so everything will be okay. And Atue looks at him and goes, "Are there people like you in heaven?" And what he meant was, "Are there people like the people who have started this colonization campaign there?" And the priest said, "Yes, of course, there's many." And Hatue then responds famously, he says, "Then I would rather go to hell, because there's no way I would want to spend eternity with people or in a place where a god would allow such cruel people to live." So, and I'm paraphrasing a bit, but that was more or less what he said. "And I would rather go to hell, because I do not want to spend eternity with people like you, and I will never believe in or worship a god who would allow such cruel people to do such cruel things," right before he was executed. And we still have and I've seen it in Baracoa in eastern Cuba, where he was executed. There's a big statue and monument to him commemorating that moment.
Unbelievable. You know, can I tell you something? Growing up, my great uncle, I won't say he detested Taino culture or Indio, but he was very raised in a Jibaro tradition, Puerto Rican. Mm. Like, when I say Jibaro, he was raised barefooted and so on.
Right, I know. For us, the equivalent is Guajiros.
The Guajiros, right. So,
Guajiro,
so for some reason, he came in 1950s during that Operation Bootstrap. And he eventually became a business owner here in New York, bodegas, you know. But check this out. He never had the desire to go back. You know, he says, "I never want to live that way again." So I used to pick his mind all the time, you know, like, "Well, how did you live?" You know, and this and that. And at least once a year, right, he will tell me the story of Hatue. And he would say it with such passion. And I'm saying to myself, wow, it's like he has no idea that I'm getting his passion, but he's trying to hide it, you know. He's trying to, like, not influence me. But yet he's giving me this story at least once a year, Hatue. And with a twinkle in his eye, you know, a whole resistance, you know. So I'm like, it's... No matter what, as much as he tried to erase it, it's still there. You know, that whole spirit of resistance, and, you know, and that's Hatue. That was Hatue.
I mean, sorry, I mispronounced it. Hatue.
Hatue.
I
was
on my Taino language. Yeah.
No, it's all right. No, but I was raised with Hatue. I'm telling you, you know.
Of course. Me too. And it's funny for Cuban people, especially. You know, because Cuba has been about rebellion basically for the last at least 60 years and everything. You know, the culture and the spirit of it is all about, you know, being the underdog and rebelling against, you know, the big powerful overlords. So it's funny that obviously what happened with the 59 revolution is not nearly the same thing, but because Cuba really values that spirit of rebellion and fighting back against, you know, the oppressors and the powerful, they really love the story of Hatue, and he is considered like Cuba's OG rebel, you know what I mean? He's considered the first, basically,
Definitely.
Rebel of Cuba, so he's really a big cultural hero, along with, you know, Jose Marti and a lot of other people who came along much later, but... You know, they remember him, and they don't forget that. And so, I mean, there's a song I remember hearing by a Cuban singer that my grandmother used to play on the radio, on her old radio. So it's really interesting to hear that. And, yeah, so I grew up with him, too. He was, like I said, he was our first the first person to fight for Cuban independence, really, because he was fighting for the independence of his people, who were the original people of Cuba, and for the liberation of the island from these colonizers. And, you know, he unfortunately didn't succeed, but God, what a way to go out, you know? I mean, he's remembered for that. I mean, the fact that we're still talking about him all these years later, and that people remember the words he spoke, you know, the very words he spoke right before he was burned alive and with nothing else to lose, that he said that, and that we remember it was, I think that's pretty incredible and really speaks to that spirit, that indomitable spirit that is Saino.
Yeah. No, I'm telling you, many years ago, I wrote a play called Cacique Hatue, the Luis Lopez story. I've been revising it in recent times because it's a play about Hatue and the modern character, Luis Lopez. But I'm telling you, he's close to my heart, man. I'll tell you, Cacique Hatue.
Yeah,
that's,
me too.
But, you know, it must be ironic, though. Uh-huh. No, I'm just saying,
yeah,
it must be ironic.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, it must be ironic that you have this figure of Hatue, historical. And like you said, without getting into the politics, what I'm thinking of is oppression, lack of freedom,
right.
Loss of freedom. So Hatue is like a constant reminder of this resistance, right? It must be really difficult,
right.
Frustrating.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, I'm talking about Taino history, so I won't get into what's been going on in Cuba right now for the past 60-some years. But it is. And originally, in the early days of the revolution, you know, people could promote the idea of the revolution as being a noble cause and resistance and rebellion, similar to the campaigns of Hatue and many other freedom fighters before then, because things were so bad under Batista. And, of course, we all know the idea of kind of communist socialism in its purest form is not a terrible thing, really, because it basically is the idea of equality for everybody, right? Like, why should the rich and power be the most powerful? Unfortunately, as we have seen throughout history, it never works, really, right? Like, any country that's tried it, it's just not worked out because it always ends up becoming corrupt, and the people at the top still are in control, unfortunately. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's a really tough situation. But at the time, after living years under Batista, who was a really, you know, really horrible totalitarian dictator, you get these guys who come along preaching equality and they're educated, you know. Che Guevara was a doctor, Castro was a lawyer. People rallied behind that. And there, again, it was this idea of resistance and fighting back against the oppressors. Unfortunately, then those people who were fighting became the oppressors, in my opinion, after a while. But at the time, you know, people didn't know what else to do, really. And it's unfortunate, but, you know, they did a lot of comparisons to when Cuba first rebelled from Spain, and a lot of the resistance against the United States as well. And, of course, they always, you know, waved that banner of Hatue as well, saying, we're basically all the same. We're all rebels fighting for the more noble cause against the powerful who are trying to oppress us. But again,
that's
unfortunately,
right.
Things don't work out, and people become greedy and corrupt, and it doesn't work out the way it's advertised. I would say, but you know, it's a powerful image to post, right? I mean, it's a powerful thing when you're claiming that you're behind the same cause as this indigenous guy from hundreds of years ago and his noble fight and noble cause and that amazing moment of when he was finally brought down, but those
mm-hmm.
powerful words he spoke, it's a powerful thing to people. I mean, if I had been around in that time, I mean, who knows? I probably would have thought, yeah, that sounds good to me, right?
Definitely, man. That's that influence. And he lived on. Those invaders didn't, but he lived on.
Right, exactly. That's what I think is the most amazing thing, that even though he technically lost at that time, I feel like it's his name we remember, right? I don't remember the name of the priest that was talking to him.
Exactly.
I'm sure it's written down somewhere, but the hell if I remember it, the hell if anyone does. And there's no statue of him anywhere in Cuba, but there's tons of statues of Hatue.
Mm-hmm.
And even the one statue in Baracoa, it even says, I'm pretty sure it says Primer Rebel de Cuba. So literally first rebel of Cuba.
Wow, that's amazing. See, that's what I mean. It's so ironic, right? You have a rebel, but yet you got,
absolutely,
you know, the other side too.
Right. But if you ever get a chance to go to Cuba, I would definitely, you go see that statue in that place where technically they believe he was executed. It's a really, for me, it was a really profound and powerful experience, you know, just to,
mm-hmm,
to look into that face. I mean, this is obviously a statue been reconstructed, but looking at it, I felt like I was looking in the face of Hatue, you know. I could see the strength, I could see the courage, I could see just the spirit of him still there.
Yeah. Yeah, I know when I got my 23andMe, I saw that I have six provinces came up, or regions came up on me. First place was Havana.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Havana. But
nice. Which is the Taino,
you know,
word.
Oh, really? Havana?
Yeah, yeah.
That's
a lot,
right,
of the a lot of the names of the Cuban provinces come from Taino words, and Habana was one of them. Camagüey, Guantanamo, Baracoa. I could go on and on.
Well, I'm thinking, since my haplogroup on my mom's side is A2, which is the you know, the Central American, Mexican region.
Right.
I'm thinking that my indigenous migration probably came from Cuba, and it ended up in Quisqueya, and then eventually Borinquen. That's my theory. Because in Jet Match, I do have some ancient Quisqueyano DNA as well. So I think Cuba was my first experience, my ancestral experience. So I got
awesome.
One day I would love to go.
I really hope. People are always asking me, when am I going to be able to go to Cuba? You know, people who with no connection to Cuba other than they want to go because they hear it's cool. Are always asking me about, you know, when's that going to change? I can't tell you, man. I mean, it's the fact that it's lasted as long as it has. I mean, this is a communist regime that has outlasted all the ones in Eastern Europe and everything. It's crazy that it is still around. But what are you going to do? But it's interesting also. So before the communist regime, there were actually, when Cuba was kind of in its early days of colonization, what I found out, which I always think is really cool, is there were these sort of proto-reservations set up for indigenous people. They weren't called reservations, but there were seven towns, actually, in total, that were set up specifically for indigenous people, mostly in eastern Cuba. And the one that has endured the most is the one, you know, we've spoken about before, is the Caridad de los Indios in Guantanamo. But just the fact that back in the day, they actually did set aside these seven communities that was meant to be for indigenous people only. So to me, that sounds, I don't know about you, that sounds like a reservation to me.
Yes, definitely. I totally agree. Definitely. So,
yeah, so
what, tell me. Uh-huh.
No, go ahead.
No, have you visited that community and stuff? Or?
Unfortunately, no. I do know people from there, and my great-grandmother was actually from that area as well. She's the one I traced my Taino ancestry originally to. The Caridad de los Indios, as a lot of people know, there's been a lot of work done there in terms of the continuance of Taino culture and the people who live there. You know, Dr. Jose Barreiro, and a lot of other people, actually academics, have visited that place because it is one of the most well-preserved kind of indigenous communities and most enduring indigenous communities, and one of the biggest clans or indigenous families that live there is the Rojas Ramirez clan, and that's led by, you know about Cacique Panchito. There was the book written by him or about him by Dr. Jose, the Old Man of the Mountains, I think it was called. So I do know him, and I know his nephew as well. I'm pretty friendly with his nephew. We've talked before on the phone and on Facebook and everything. So they are still very, very tied to their indigenous heritage. And he is always, his nephew, Giovanni is his name, is always sending me pictures and photos. And you know, he said, oh, we take like monthly or weekly pilgrimages up into the mountains for ceremonies. We do a lot of cooking in the traditional indigenous style. A lot of them practice farming of things like tobacco and everything in the traditional way. So he's always sending me information about that. And it's really cool to see that a lot of things have remained so unchanged in that village. I mean, obviously, over the time, things have been incorporated from various other influences and cultures. I mean, how can it not be? This was a colonized place. You had a lot of different people coming and going through there, Spaniards, African people, and naturally cultural syncretism occurs, as I've spoken about before. It happens, but there are some things, even just the way they plant their crops and the way they cook them, the prayers they use, the songs they sing, those pilgrimages to the mountains, to these like sacred sites that they go to, all of that
right.
comes from traditional Taíno practice. And just to be able to see that people are still doing it so many years later is really amazing to me. And you know, a lot of people we mentioned this before, people say, oh, it's not the same because now there's influences from other cultures, African, Spanish, etc. But again, I don't agree with that personally. As an anthropologist, as a Taíno person, as an academic in general, because culture is always changing and shifting and adapting, and that's true anywhere. Nothing exists exactly the same as it was hundreds of thousands of years ago. It's just not possible, really. Change is inevitable.
Sure.
So that, to me, that doesn't make it any less authentic, though, you know. It doesn't make it any less Taíno. It doesn't make it any less true. It doesn't make it any less real.
Exactly. Well, you know, I remember several years ago, I got thrown out of Taíno 101 because I was at the Facebook group because I was defending Taíno
yeah,
Christians.
Yeah, I'm aware of it.
Taínos who were Christians. So it's like,
right.
Wait a minute, you can't be a Christian and Taíno at the same time? That doesn't make sense. So it seems
yeah,
like
I know a ton of Taíno Christians.
so here's the thing, you know, we're allowed. I'm not a Christian, but I think we're allowed to choose whatever. Our ethnicity is Taíno, right? But
right,
yeah, that's something that frustrates me. And I think when we study our culture, you know, this is kind of stuff that divides us. I believe that's not counterproductive. I don't know. I just don't feel like.
No, I agree.
We should be focusing
on that.
Right?
Yeah, because faith is a very, in my opinion, a very personal thing. You know, it's not, obviously it's influenced by your culture and your birthplace and things of that nature. But in the end, it's what you follow, the path that you most believe in, right? Or what speaks to
yeah.
you, or sometimes a combination of paths. I mean, my father was Church of Scotland Presbyterian. I was technically baptized in a Presbyterian Christian church. And, you know, do I consider myself a Christian? Not really, or not at least not a strict one. But I incorporate elements of Christianity into my beliefs. I, for example, I certainly believe, and my father did as well, in the idea of universal love and kindness that, that Jesus preached, the idea of the golden rule of treating others as you would wish to be treated. You know, I mean, it doesn't have to be one or the other, really. You can incorporate a lot of things from various traditions. And yeah, I think a lot of terrible, I don't agree with a lot of Christianity. I think a lot of terrible things have been done in the name of it, but I certainly believe in that. I certainly believe in that idea, and my father was the same way. He said, you know, I don't really care for anything else, but I believe in the idea of universal love, and I believe in the idea of kindness and generosity, and that's mainly mm-hmm. what I choose to follow. And I believe in that too. And so that whole idea that you can't be, that they're mutually exclusive, does not jive with me. As an academic, as a person of mixed heritage, it's just, you know, people are multifaceted. No one's ever 100% one or the other. And then people often follow paths that they weren't necessarily born into. You know, I know people who've chosen to follow Judaism, even though they weren't born Jewish. I've known people to follow Islam or other things that they just feel speak to them, you know? So to me, religion and spirituality, that's personal. That's no one's business. If you feel something speaks to you, no matter where you're from or who your ancestors were, then go for it.
Right. So you see someone like Panchito, right? Who,
right.
Who's considered like a modern day cacique because, you know, he has this community there and in Cuba, and you know, I've seen videos of him talking, and he's, you know, I remember one video he was saying that it's la tienda, this is the store, and it's like his conuco, his crops, and it's
right.
like
everything
was good, yeah, but everything was growing per season, so it was never bare, there was always something growing, so he was, you know, he's teaching how they do that, you know, every plant, every crop has different seasons, and so we never go hungry, you know. So I'm like, wow, this is some deep technology, huh? But he's talking in
Absolutely.
Spanish, you know. He's talking in Spanish,
of course.
You know, and he has you know, modern clothing. So do people see him as an indigenous man, or, you know, with this technology of indigenous, or, you know, technology, or is he a Latino? Is he Cuban? You know, like, where does it start? Where does it end? You know,
again, that's the thing. I don't believe they're all mutually exclusive. So one good example I would use. So the idea of indigeneity or the native people of Cuba was really oppressed and buried kind of for a long time during the revolution, and that was because. Yeah, it was because that they really wanted to promote this idea of, like, singular Cubanness, you know? They didn't really want to push the idea of racial differences and ethnicities, not just with indigenous people, but with black, Spanish. They didn't want that because the idea behind communism and that whole equality they were pushing is we're all Cuban. We're all our identity is the nation state, is Cubanismo, is being Cuban. Mm. So it doesn't matter if you're black Cuban or white Cuban or mulatto or mestizo Cuban. So it really dissuaded distinct racial identification in terms of being, and that applied to being indigenous, of course, too. In favor of this singular mindset of Cubanness, and that was intended to equalize everyone. You know what I mean? It was basically this idea of we're all the same. And there, you know, there's some credence to that, of course, because there was obviously racial inequality and disparity, particularly to Cubans who were black or who were Indio or mestizo or mulatto. And the idea was to get rid of that racial disparity. But at the same time, the unfortunate side effect was that they really kind of pushed this idea of we're not going to even acknowledge the indigenous tradition of Cuba, because we don't want to focus on racial distinctiveness, you know? But
exactly.
But the good thing is, in recent years at least, because the one good thing I would say about us Cubanos is that we love to learn. We're very, and even post-revolution and everything, one of the good things that did come out of it was this push and focus on education.
Oh, right.
So,
with
the Castro Revolution and everything, some protocol was set in place, including that everybody has to go to school up through pretty much finishing high school. Everybody has to learn to read. There was a lot of funding given to universities and higher institutes of education. So the one good thing that did come out of that is this love for learning and this passion for being educated and that value on education. So even though a lot of bad things happen, that's one good thing I really take from it. And because of that, Cuba is considered the most literate country in all of Latin America, and has kind of a higher rate of education, because everybody by law has to finish high school, you know? So that I consider a good thing. And what naturally came out of that was this interest in Cuba's history, you know, and they don't just mean the history of the revolution that is being pushed nowadays. They mean all of history, because the revolution is just a blip, technically, a very brief, recent blip in the history of Cuba in general. So a lot of these academics, like Jose, like many other people, have been interested in things before that and long before that. So there's been sort of a resurgence and renewed interest in indigenous culture in Cuba, even though it sort of flies in the face of what the state has been promoting. And that's what kind of makes it difficult to really get out there, you know, or to get funding at least for the types of DNA projects or research like we've seen done in Oregon and in the Dominican Republic, because that's not really something the state really supports, you know what I mean? They don't put their interest there. Doesn't mean it's not happening, but it's not at the top of the priority list, and it's harder to really make it a thing because it's
sure.
Again, sort of flies in the face of what the revolution preaches and or what the revolution has preached and what the modern zeitgeist really preaches too. So, but it still happened, and that's why there's been so much renewed interest, and there's been a lot of interest lately taken in the Caridad de los Indios and Cacique Panchito and his family.
Mm-hmm.
Smithsonian did a whole article about it in 2016. Those books, like I said, Jose wrote those books, and now Giovanni, Panchito's nephew, even told me that Cuba even wants to make a documentary now about the family, which is a big milestone too. That the fact that the state itself wants to make a documentary when it's state that's kind of swept the idea of indigeneity under the rug. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's major. It's a major shift.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And again, I think a lot of it chalks up to, I think we're just, Cuba in general is moving in a more progressive direction now that most of the original revolutionaries are either, you know, Fidel is dead, everyone else is getting really old, and the young people, at least from my generation, from what I can tell, because I've been there, I've talked to my family and friends who are of my age, they're really not interested in those old ideas. They're more about being inclusive and learning and being progressive and really getting on the same page as the rest of the free world. So I think we owe a lot of it to that, as well as the idea that obviously the Taínos were never left, you know, they were never gone, and the culture was never gone. It was just kind of buried for a while, but this kind of very slow yet definite resurgence that we're seeing is a combination of that and now that people's focus is not on rebelling, you know, people's focus is more on learning who they are as Cubans and where they come from. And going back to what you said about Panchito, is he Latino? Is he Cuban? Is he Taino? In my opinion, he's all of them. And that's okay. You know, there's not, you can be all of them. In my opinion, I am Latina. I am also Taina, and I am also Cuban, you know, and I can be Cubana, sorry. And I can be all three, and they are not mutually exclusive, and that does not mean I give credence or preference to one over the other. It's right. Just all part of who I am. And on my dad's side, I'm also Scottish, Irish, and German. So I you can be all of them, because Latino means anybody from the Latin countries who usually is the product of Spain, but also the indigenous culture that Spain colonized from that respective country. Then you're also, whatever country you come from, you're Mexican or you're Chilean or you're Boricuan, whatever you want. But then if you are like us and you have a tie to your indigenous tribal nation, you're also tribal nation as well. It's like I've talked to Native people in the United States who are Navajo or Cherokee or Lakota, and they'll say they are that, but they're also American. And does that make them any less Lakota or Navajo or Cherokee? Not in my opinion.
It's true, right? Well, I look at my passport and it says American. I'm like, whoa, I'm American.
Right, yeah, you know? Of course. I mean, it's just one of your many, you know, again, people are multifaceted. There's not one identity for all of us, right? We're all, a lot of things come into play, especially in America where we're all from multiple places, right? I mean, there's very few Americans that I know anyway who are all from one place in terms of their ancestry and their heritage. So you can identify, you can be a proud American, and that's great, but you're also probably a bunch of other stuff too, and if you want to identify as all of those, you know, more power to you. Again, I don't see it as a detriment, and I don't see it as disloyalty to any part of your identity. Again, to me, identity is very personal. So however you choose to identify is you, and people just need to respect that.
That's right, yeah, because I see Taino identity as an ethnicity, and with that, mm-hmm. there's a whole bunch of other stuff that, you know, it's free choice, right? Free will, and you know, one of my favorite hip hop stars is Superman. He's of the Crow Nation up in Montana.
Oh yeah, you know, yeah.
He's a hip hop artist. You know, he dresses like a hip hop artist. His music is definitely hip hop, but he's Crow. You know, so he's a Crow hip hop artist. So it's like cool, and he's also a Catholic actually. A lot of people don't know that, even though
they play
traditional
yeah.
music. So it's like, I think one thing is Taino community, we have to you know, embrace it all and but be true to our ethnicity, who we are as a people. You know, we are indigenous people. And with that, there's a lot
right.
of stuff.
Absolutely. And I think part of our survival has been our ability to adapt and incorporate, right? Because
that's right.
if you don't,
yeah.
That's you know, your fast pass to dying out completely, right? And losing yourselves as a people. Mm-hmm. But being flexible, being adaptable, being able to incorporate as the world around you changes so drastically as it did with colonization, and being able to roll with that, that's all part of it. If you can't do that, you're screwed.
Well, that was the ultimate weapon, I think, that we use against the colonizer, is that we were able to adapt, you know, adapt to the situation. Take a lot of
right.
the abuse. We took a lot of abuse, especially the women. But we adapted
oh, yeah.
and we kept the traditions alive, at least indirectly or secretly. But we're still
right.
here, right?
Absolutely. So, I think we owe acknowledgement of that. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I fully acknowledge that I'm part Spanish too. Even though the Spaniards obviously were the colonizers who did all this atrocious stuff, but that is part of who I am. If they hadn't done what they did, I wouldn't be here. So I am of that descent as well, and I need to acknowledge that. I don't need to be. That doesn't mean I approve of or am proud of what they did.
Mm-hmm.
My culture and my heritage comes from both sides, and I don't think that's anything to be ashamed. You know, I didn't have any say in it. It's just what happened, and because my ancestors were strong enough to endure that colonization and that admixing that they did against their will most of the time, I am here. And we all are here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, like I like that phrasing that, you know, we're indigenous and with some Spanish influence, African influence, you know, because they came later
right.
on, right? They came later. But, you know, we don't reject it all. We don't reject it.
No.
We take the good.
We
take the positive. Get rid of what we don't
right.
need, right? And I think
right.
that's what...
Right. Of course, you condemn the negative, but you can take the positive out of it. I mean, I love flamenco music. I don't know about anyone else, but yeah, I always thought and flamenco dancing. You know, my mom used to do that. I always thought it was fun. It was cool. It was great. And there's something kind of very primal and indigenous about it too, because that's what the you know, Gitano or Gypsy Spaniards would do. And I always thought that was really interesting. So it's taking the good with the bad, you know?
Yeah, you're right. It's funny, when I look at my 23andMe and my what do you call it, 23andMe and Ancestry, when I compare them, it seems like the first peoples that weren't indigenous, that intermix, were actually Jewish. It wasn't even Spanish. It was Jewish. And then came
oh,
the
really?
African. Yeah, and then around 1750, some Spanish people showed up in my bloodline. So it's quite interesting, right?
Right.
So
was it like Sephardi Jewish, or did it get that specific, or?
It said Ashkenazi Jewish.
Ashkenazi, European.
Yeah, it was Ashkenazi that mixed with the indigenous the first time.
Gotcha. Wow. That's
only,
an interesting.
Yeah, right? So I think
I mean, Sephardi I hear a lot because, you know, Sephardi were the big Jews or the biggest Jewish mm-hmm. population of Spain. So that would make sense. But Ashkenazi, that's interesting.
Yeah, and I know I learned this from Nahuake, is that there's a Jewish community in Ayunque, in Puerto Rico, and they practice their Judaism, but they also practice indigenous rituals as well, and it's very exclusive.
That's the idea mm-hmm. again of can you be both? And in my opinion, yeah, you can be. You can mm-hmm. be Christian. I mean, I know a lot of Native Christians or Native American Christians from various tribes who, I mean, the whole idea of the Native American church that came around that incorporated Christianity mm-hmm. with traditional tribal spirituality and practices speaks
exactly.
to that very idea of syncretism and combining a lot of the two or more.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, Panchito and his community, I think one thing they teach us is that if you can stick together, you know, wonderful
right.
things can happen, you know, preserving the culture. That's one
Absolutely.
Thing I see in him, right?
Right.
Yeah, in Cuba.
I feel like, you know, Cuba's African population often gets pushed to the side or treated unfairly, but they have contributed so much to Cuban culture. And when they were brought over, you know, as slaves, it was them and the Taino who were the first allies, really, because the Taino were slaves too. And now these new people are brought over. So runaway slaves and Taino often got together. They would join each other's communities or incorporate each other into each other's communities, combine a lot of their traditions. And so
mm-hmm.
I really, I think that's a beautiful, amazing thing. And we shouldn't be, nobody should be ashamed of that or kind of downplay that influence, that very important influence that they had, because without them, we may not have survived to who and what we are today, and vice versa. You know, we helped each other out. That's what we did through our unity and through our ability to adapt to each other's cultures. So that idea of just saying, okay, well, if it's got African influence, it's not authentic, or if it's this, it's not authentic, is kind of a moot point, in my opinion, because it's all a part of our history, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you don't mind, next week, maybe we can start, we can do a part two of this, because I have some people write me about they wanted to call in, and because they have some Cuban blood as well, so they wanted to share.
Absolutely.
So maybe next week,
yeah,
we can get some callers and discuss this whole indigenous continuity in Cubao. Cubao, right?
Yeah, Cubao. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm always psyched to talk to fellow Taínos Cubanos, because again, I feel like we're kind of a underrepresented population in the Taíno community, or where there's not a whole lot of us, at least, who are involved in the Taíno community that I know of, or who are as outspoken about it anyway. So yeah, anyone. And even if you just have something to say or something to add, always happy to hear about that too from anyone from anywhere.
Yeah, you know what? I want to try to get some clips of Panchito. I want to try to download those some clips, see what he has to say.
Sure,
you know?
Yeah, they're all over the place.
Try to. You know,
he's so cool.
He is cool, right? Yeah, man. You know, as a kid, I remember
he's such a chill guy.
Yeah, I've seen tons of stuff from him, you know, in his community. But, you know, it's interesting that when I was a kid, we used to have a neighbor. We used to call him Cuba Libre. You know, he's Cuban. And we call him Cuba Libre.
Of
that
course,
was his name.
Yeah.
I remember people
and
calling him Cuba.
And that's also a great drink, you know.
Cuba Libre. We say, mira, Cuba Libre.
Cuba Libre.
And
that's
an older
just
man.
The fact I assume so. This was where you grew up, you said?
Yeah, in East New York, he was an older man, and he had his hat, that Caribbean hat, and
Guajiro
he had a
hat,
cigar.
Yeah.
The Guajiro hat, he always had a cigar, so I remember. So I'm thinking of him right now. He's going, Cuba Libre.
Did he wear a guayabera?
Yes, of course. I remember that. He was very good friends with my great grandfather, who used to make cigars. He used to make cigars. Yeah.
Oh wow!
He was a tobacco farmer back in Puerto Rico, and a cigar maker. So they were very good friends. So I was actually raised, man, with that Cuban influence. You know, with the cigar.
The fact that cigars are such like a big thing in Cuba, such a staple of what is Cuban culture, is goes back to the indigeneity of it too, because tobacco comes from the Taíno, right? And and even just the fact that, you know, that phrase Cuba Libre, like free Cuba and everything, the fact that is so quintessentially Cuban, I think goes again to what I was saying before, the fact that Cuba we were always rebels, you know, we're always fighting for something. We're always fighting for some kind of freedom, right? So
no matter what
time period it is and who we're fighting against, be it the Spaniards, be it the U.S., be it the colonizers, be it the U.S., be it Spain, be it the Batista regime, it's always like, you know, we're always fighting for something. We're still fighting to free Cuba after all these years. So it's just funny that has become such a iconic phrase of Cuban people. And again, it all goes back to that rebel spirit that we have, right?
I will never forget that. I will never forget that memory. You know, I was like, wow, that's an old memory. But he was so chill.
Yeah, Cuba Libre.
You know, I always drank their coffee.
Of course. Oh, yeah. You ever had that? Man, that is.
Oh, man. It's like an oil, right? I think it's oil.
Oh, God. It's so sweet, too. And it's like, you need, I mean, you have that first thing in the morning, you'll be going for like 24 hours. And people, my family would drink like several cups a day, and they'd have it in the afternoon and everything. I'm like, nah, I can't do that.
Well, yeah, I knew Jibaros in Puerto Rico, they have the, they drink from the coffee can. They use the can, the empty can, as a coffee mug.
Oh.
And they're drinking. I've seen that. So you know what,
that's
man?
Just
that's
it. See, we just use those little cups because you can only take it in small doses, really.
Oh, man, I'm telling you, you know what, man? The bottom line is we have that indigenous spirit of community, spirit
right.
of brother sisterhood. Just, you know, just
Absolutely.
Getting along. We're all getting along. We're all getting it done together.
Right.
You know? And I missed that as a kid.
For sure.
You know, all the people getting together and just, you know, not arguing about, you know, if you're Christian or you this and that. But just smoking a nice cigar and drinking some coffee and thinking about
having
the old country.
Having some Havana
right?
Club rum.
Yeah, just thinking of the old country. Oh, yeah, I forgot about the rum part. Yeah, but.
Oh, God. That's you know what I was saying before? You're not supposed to take anything back from Cuba when you visit. That's something we always took back.
Oh, where? The Cuban rum?
Oh, yeah. My mom would always, like, hide a bottle in the suitcase. I think we still have some somewhere, like some 10-year-old aged. We only bring it out on special occasions, you know, Havana Club, because you can't get it here. And to me,
wow, look at that.
Yeah, to me, a true mojito, you need Havana Club rum to make a true mojito. And same with the Cuba Libre drink, you know, that's basically a rum and Coke, but it's got to be Havana Club rum, or it's not a real Cuba Libre.
Oh, man, that's... Hey, next week, let's drink some virtual, what do you call it? We'll smoke some cigars and then we'll do some mojitos.
Right. Oh, my God. Yeah, every time, like, you know, here in America, obviously, you're only going to get, you're never going to get that. But that was the one thing whenever I went to Europe and I saw Havana Club, I'd get so excited. I'm like, oh, my God, I haven't seen this since last time I was in Cuba, man. Like, this is great.
Well, that's dope, man. That's dope. Well, listen, we ran out of time. We always run out of time.
Yeah.
What's going on? It's
I
cold
know.
And all this.
Oh, man, we talk too much.
I know. Man. So you want to do part two next week? Want to go for it, man, part two?
Yeah,
Cuba
sure.
Libre.
Absolutely. Cuba Libre. I'm so happy to have anybody call in, ask any questions, share any stories, any thoughts. You don't have to be Cubano, but you as long as you have something cool to say, it's all good.
Yeah, I got some people chatting. They say, yeah, man, you know, they got on here late, but yeah, let's do it. Let's do it next week, and I'll get some
right.
clips. We can download Panchito's own words, you know. So what's up, man? All right.
Yeah.
All right,
That'll be great.
Yeah, man. So all right, man. So listen.
Should I go out singing Guantanamera right now? I feel like I should do that.
Hey, man, if you're game, just do it. Do you know the song?
Of course. Every Cuban knows that song, man. You're not a real Cuban unless you don't know that song.
All right. I'm sitting here. I'm listening. Go for it.
Okay. If you know the chorus, you got to sing with me, all right? I'm just going to do the first verse or else we'll be here all night.
Oh, my God. I'll follow through. Go ahead. Go for it.
By the way, Guajiro, the equivalent of Jibaro for us, you know, a Guajiro is somebody who comes from Guantanamera. So.
Oh, damn. There you go.
Yeah.
Man, I got to hear
All right. Don't judge me too harsh. Okay.
Nah, man. Hey, I love it.
Yo soy un hombre sincero, de donde crecen las palmas. Yo soy un hombre sincero, de donde crecen las palmas. Y antes de morir, yo quiero canta los versos de arma, Guantanamera. Guajira, Guantanamera. Yeah, canta conmigo. Guantanamera. Guajira, Guantanamera.
Wow. No.
All right, so dogs are barking out here.
Well, we're going to do it next week with some mojitos. There we go. Some,
oh, yeah, absolutely. Everybody, get your mojitos ready.
I love it. I love it. So, okay, man. So what a way to end the show, man. So I'll see you next week, okay?
Absolutely.
We got this. Cuba Libre, man. Thank you so much. All right,
yes,
man. Thank you. Blessings.
Yes.
No problem.
Igual.
Thank you. Peace out, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. TainoRadio.com.